Hey everybody, welcome to the Monday edition of the Daily Friend Show. That's right, that's the Daily Friend Show that comes to you every Monday, Wednesday and Friday, with Friday of course being the visual show that you can find on the Daily Friend YouTube channel. That'll be coming to you soon indeed. Guys, I'm your host, Big Daddy Liberty. I'm not alone, I'm joined by a who's who panel of IRR colleagues. I'll begin with a colleague on my right, that's Sara Gunn. Sara Gunn, of course, is the contributing editor, the chief editor of the Daily Friend. Sara, how are you doing?
Thank you.
Let's try that again. Sara, how are you doing?
I'm still doing well.
And of course, in studio with moi, I've got a voice who I think you guys are rather very familiar with now. A chap who you guys always sort of pass funny comments on the televised show as to why he looks so grumpy. Maurice Ruth, of course, who are head of campaigns. Maurice, how's it homes?
Hey, how's it, Sihle? I think I was so grumpy because of what we did in the Cricket World Cup. Hopefully the Rugby World Cup will be better this year.
Amen, don't jinx it. And of course, last but not least in studio, I've got a full house today, is a chap who you guys I know like the analysis and calm, rational voice from, Nicholas Lorimer, who's of course a analyst here at the IRR. Nick, how's it, homie?
Yeah, I'm doing good, Zichler.
Awesome, guys. Guys, there's quite a few topics I want us to open this week with. Just stuff that I think I want people to chew on as, you know, interesting, you know, tidbits, or rather interesting topics that I think will define the news week. Top of mind is Brexit. Brexit is looking ever increasingly like a cluster mess, if I can avoid the swear word. With Boris Johnson facing a mutiny on his hands to an extent, but also at the same time taking charge of a messy situation. Nicholas, I'm going to begin with you. Boris Johnson, can he pull it off? What does he need to do to pull a Brexit off at this stage?
What he needs to do probably is hold a general election. So there's a lot of complexity in what exactly has been going on. There's a lot of technical points of what Parliament has to do. But basically, he's now pushed it towards an election, and he's also thrown out of his own party many people who are Remainers. So the stakes are very high right now, and Boris has kind of challenged the rest of the political establishment to a do or die. Either they have an election and decide whether he's going to actually be Remainers Prime Minister and pursue his Brexit strategy, or they're going to delay and suspend further. Although it's been... there have been so many shakeups, it's actually difficult to kind of follow them. He had a resignation from his cabinet, his brother resigned, who was also, you know, involved in the government. His brother's resigned entirely as an MP. And there's stories going around on the Associated Press that France will not accept any extension of the Brexit deadline by the UK. Now, I'm not sure whether that's confirmed yet or not. But the point is, things are getting pretty tense as we hurtle towards October 31st, which is when the UK is supposed to leave, with or without a deal.
Now, Nicholas, before I let you go on this topic, there's something particularly special, and I think one has to sort of listen and pay attention to, when you say a character like Boris Johnson is looking to go to an election. The idea of an election itself, that's where this whole thing began, didn't it? Brexit was ultimately a referendum, an election of sort, where the majority, I wouldn't say vast, but the majority of Brits voted to leave. And since then, we've just had a sequence of events of politicians, both MPs and ministers and the like, and of course the various associated organizations, whether they're NGOs and vested interest groups, seeking to delay the will of the people. What stops, and I'm asking you to forecast a little bit here, but let's say we go to an election in the UK and Boris wins with a majority. What stops these same groupings from continuing the delay tactics and the nonsense and shenanigans that we've been seeing, which is against the will of the British people?
Well, the idea is that Boris will only have candidates selected for the Conservative Party who are on board with his Brexit and the strategy. So one of the central problems with this entire process has been the fact that the British constitutional system is not set up to do referendums properly. In a place like America, or maybe even South Africa, where you have a written constitution and the legislature is much more constrained, you can make a referendum and say, oh, well, this is binding on the legislature. They have to enact this. But in the British system, Parliament is supreme. Parliament can do whatever it likes. There's actually no restraint on its power whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So it's actually entirely legal for Parliament to completely undermine the referendum that it voted and say, no, actually, we're going to ignore it completely. But of course, that violates democratic principle. And so now we're in a situation where you have a Parliament that is expressly against the majority vote. And there's a lot of people who now believe that if they just keep delaying Brexit a little bit more, maybe they can scuttle the whole thing.
Guys, I'm going to open this conversation up because I'm also cognizant of the fact that, look, the election itself was very close. I mean, I'm not saying like Brexit won with a landslide. Of course, there is a sizable portion of the population that wanted to remain, in the EU. So I'm going to kind of put you on the spot because I know we all differ in our views in this particular office. So we don't have one single view, and that's totally fine. I like that. But if you're a Remainer and you recognize, I'm going to situate you in the situation. Mm. If you're a Remainer and you recognize, look, okay, fine, we lost the particular vote, the referendum, what is the scenario that you would want as an outcome in this? Yes, we know we're leaving the EU, but what would you want as the compromise, if I can call it that way?
Well, what strikes me as funny, and I'm by no means an expert on this, but what strikes me as funny is if you take the view that the referendum, for better or for worse, was won with a majority that said leave the EU, the response should have been, damn it, we lost. Let's see what the best deal we can get in leaving the EU. But my sense is that a lot of this chaos has occurred around the idea of Remainers of, well, actually, if we just fight hard enough, maybe we'll remain. Mm. And that strikes me as odd. It also, the thing is, if you go to an election, I mean, you've got Labour candidates who are Remainers representing constituencies who are distinctly Brexiteers. I don't know how they expect to be voted in again.
Mm. Morris?
Well, we had this discussion beforehand, and I'm probably in a very small minority in this organisation, but I don't think there would be a problem with having a second referendum. Because I think an analogy would be you and 10 of your friends, you're going out to a restaurant, and you say, should we go to the fish place or the steak place? Six of you say, let's go to the steak place. So that's a majority. You get the fish place, and the chef comes out and says, how's it, guys? I've just got word that all my fish is poisoned, and if you eat it, you will die. And everybody's like, well, the thing is, we did vote to come here, so we can't leave, guys. So we're going to have to just, go ahead with it. Instead of saying, well, why don't we vote again? Maybe we'll go to the steak place instead. So I think, I mean, this comes down to David Cameron made a massive mistake. He tried to solve an internal party issue with going to a referendum, which was a mistake in the first place. And he miscalculated. He thought if he gets this referendum, the Eurosceptics and the Conservative Party and UKIP will be dead for a generation, but he obviously miscalculated completely. And all the polls said that Remain would win, but I mean, Leave won, but it was all in the margin of error, actually. So it wasn't actually such a big surprise. But I think that's where David Cameron made his stuff up. And actually, David Cameron, he should actually have led the UK to wherever it ended up, leaving the EU, whatever the case was. I feel a bit sorry for poor Theresa May. She got a bit of a hospital pass, and she really wasn't hiding to nothing. So, I mean, she's going to be remembered. She probably, history won't remember her fondly, but I don't think she had much to work with, to be honest.
Yeah, so broadly speaking, I mean, I agree with what Morris just said on the whole David Cameron stuffing this up, basically, and trying to solve this internal party problem. But I disagree on a second referendum for a number of reasons, some of them practical, some of them principled. So on the principle side, people voted for something, and when you look at the way that the thing was framed, yes, during the campaign, a lot of people said, we will leave with a deal. Even Nigel Farage was saying that. But in the opening speech about it, David Cameron says, in or out, this is the chance, this is the vote of a lifetime. We won't be able to reverse this for a generation, so you have to make your voice clear. So it's clear that the impetus was behind leaving under sort of almost any circumstance. Now, the second thing is that having a second referendum won't just only undermine the sort of principle of the first referendum and that there's a, that we vote until we get the outcome we want. can you imagine how divisive that campaign would be? This campaign has been absolutely devastating for British political stability. It has torn the country apart. It has divided people along lines that they never thought. And can you imagine if, for example, the second referendum had a lower turnout than the first one? The lack of legitimacy it would have would be a problem that would scar the British political system for decades to come. And so I think that a second referendum would, at least in practical terms and in principle terms, be just a complete disaster.
What happens if you have a second referendum and the majority vote is to get out of Brexit? Because it's being largely punted along the ideas of there will be a different result. Obviously, a lot depends on the question.
But also, I think what is quite likely, if the UK does leave the EU, I think this might also be the end of the UK. Scotland voted 62% to stay in the EU, and the referendum result in 2014, I think it was actually pretty close. It was 55-45. So a little swing, and you get them leaving the EU. And also there's mess in Ireland with the Irish border, and there's growing Northern Ireland also voted to stay within the EU. So it's not impossible that we'll see a Scottish independence, and who knows, maybe the reunification of Ireland or even an independent Northern Irish state. So these are things, I mean, I see Sichler is pulling funny faces, but remember, nobody would have thought that Brexit would have happened 4 years ago. So these are things that could easily happen. And remember, the fact that Scotland has been part of the UK for 300 years and there's still such a powerful independence movement there tells you something.
Well, I don't know if that's 100% true. People aren't single-issue voters. There's various issues that really, you know, add a confluence that create a confluence of considerations for a citizen on, and I don't think Brexit will be a single issue that prompts that sort of move. For example, and let me be precise and specific, in 2014 when the Scottish held their referendum, the guys wanted to stay in the UK, actually quite a sizable, that was a convincing loss for the SNP.
It was 10 percentage points, it wasn't, I mean, 55 plus 45, not it was, so much of a 52 plus 48.
It was about 2 million votes over a million and some change. Again, that's not 100%, and as I'm talking, Morris is checking, so we'll come back with that number. But it was a decent margin for
500,000.
There we go. That's a decent margin to actually lose by, if you that is to win by, if you are a victor. And that's Nicholas. You wanted to sort of chime in.
Yeah. So one of the arguments made, one of the principal economic arguments made for Scottish independence, was that leaving the UK, you would still stay in the EU. So there would be very few problems with borders with the UK. The economy would chug along pretty much as it was going, but Scotland would be completely independent to make its own laws. If Britain leaves the EU, that economic calculus changes completely, because Scotland would have to reapply for EU membership, and its finances are not at all in the right place to get access back into the EU. So Scotland's economic case for leaving the UK is possibly the worst it could possibly be right now. And so I think that an independence move would really struggle to go against that.
Oil is very low compared to what it was. All these calculations were done when the oil price was $100.
And also, you know, I mean, regardless of that, there's a lot of higgledy-piggledy going on with the finances to kind of try and make the case that the oil would pay for everything. But I think a sort of Qatar on the North Sea is not a very likely outcome. It would more be like a sort of Northern European Nigeria.
If I'm not mistaken, Scotland proportionately chews up more of the NHI spending than any other part of
Scotland,
the United Kingdom.
Scotland benefits per head more from the Union than England.
So I'm not sure... The financials are the issue, but I'm not sure that Scotland has much to is going to be able to export or afford to import anything from the EU, or much. I don't say anything.
All right, guys. Of course, this is a lively topic. I always like this conversation. We in this office these are the sort of conversations we have almost on a day-to-day basis. But if you guys want to see and read more about this, of course, you can watch out for the Daily Friend website. That's dailyfriend.co.za. We've got very able colleagues in this office who are very knowledgeable and have a strong command over this topic. Herman Pretorius, who's not in studio at the moment, is one of those colleagues. But you can watch out for that writing, and we'll be following Brexit in our writing here at the Daily Friend. Okay, guys, I want to move on. The other topic we were sort of chewing the fat on earlier on is the issue of the essential breakdown of law and order in South Africa, and it manifests itself in various issues that have gained prominence in the news cycle. One issue, of course, that we covered last week, Maurice, you were with me in Cape Town, was the Women's March, the hashtag Am I Next March, which I warned anybody who follows my social media that there is some activist out there who'll be waiting to sort of capitalize on these sort of incidents, but that's not the topic we'll have today, but what I did want to, or sorry, let me take a step back. If you watched any of the shows we've put on the Daily Friend website, we made the point last week that, you know, the conversation around these sort of issues of the breakdown of the rule of law, and specifically those who are most affected by it, like the more vulnerable segments, such as women in this case, in terms of gender-based violence, always revolves around having those people who are seen as the victims of the said breakdown of the rule of law begging either the state to do something, or invariably begging those who are the supposed attackers or reason for their victimology, if you will, to stop doing that. And I found that conversation very weird, because on the one hand, it's almost a spectrum, and sorry, I'm going to come to you a little bit on this. It's a bit of a spectrum insofar as on the one hand, you have the virtue signalers who have no real solutions but this continuous sort of circular argument and failed ideas and really offering nothing to the conversation. And on the very end of the spectrum, you have those who then call for more state intervention. The very same inept state that hasn't helped, there's a call that we should give that same government, that same state, more powers. In fact, even powers that should offend us as liberals, you know, the power to kill citizens, you know, which violates, of course, the three things that every citizen should have, which is life, liberty, and property rights. I personally am not a favor of giving the state the power to kill people on that basis, but that's neither here nor there. But that spectrum is an annoying one because the conversation in the mainstream media happens between these two areas and there are no alternative voices. Hence, Maurice and I hit the streets of Cape Town last week in order to introduce a different argument, a different voice, one which is premised on two points. One, let's actually begin to empower the women themselves directly. There's ways you can do this. One is building a society where we mainstream those women who choose to become gun owners, having the gun rights, and of course the training and the proficiency in using it to be able to defend their own life, liberty, and property and not have to beg men to stop raping them, not having to beg government to do something about it. And of course the second one is we launched, Maurice, and I'm looking to you on this, the Community Safety Charter, which has very real interventions in it that speak to empowering citizens for them to take charge of their safety. Maurice, can we just quickly revisit this Community Safety Charter and how people can sign up to it so that we can take this fight into the public arena?
Well, what Broad Point's Community Safety Charter says is to kind of devolves your safety to people. It's we want more power for station commanders, where people can elect who their station commanders are. We think people should be given tax breaks on when they make measures to for their safety, such as on security upgrades to their homes and so on. We also think there should be, for example, policemen should be better educated. I mean, you need a university educated police corps. So it's all that kind of thing. I mean, it's all fairly easy stuff to do. They'll probably end up in quite quick wins, but it's something that we need to do and the change needs to be made. We've seen the police themselves admitted recently that they simply can't deal with what's happening in South Africa, and that's why we've been seeing things like these xenophobic riots in a couple of our cities and these high levels of femicide, which actually they've been pretty high for. We haven't seen a spike in femicide, for example. So actually, we've just seen very high levels for quite a long time.
Absolutely, and the issue itself isn't just the femicide. I'm trying to find the word to slot in here. What I'm trying to suggest is it's the whole environment in which gender-based violence happens in this country, where the individual, an individual woman who the data shows us is being abused by an intimate partner mostly, like the vast majority of these incidents happen with an intimate partner, is failed completely by not only the social structure she belongs in, where the family doesn't support because they say something like, oh no, but you married him and you must sort this out from the family, etc., etc., right up to the state level, where the state, if this woman is lucky enough to do what she needs to do, get the protection order, etc., etc., there's just no enforcement. I mean, the case, there was a case in PE of a champion boxer. This woman had a promising career ahead of her, gunned down, shot 3 times in the face by her ex-boyfriend, if I'm not mistaken, or ex-husband, who happens to be a police officer. And these are the things I'm saying we need to be getting or addressing in particular in terms of how we empower the women and not ask them to be beg for either the state to help them or, you know, this ill-defined grouping of individuals to chip in. Sarah, I'm coming to you because this, I think, annoyed you and me to great ends in terms of the virtue signaling that happens around this, where everybody wants to have a say, but no one wants to actually do something meaningful.
I think it's actually more problematic than that. And that is that the state and all its organs cannot prevent femicide. So the elephant in the room is, why are men doing this? And it has to be a combination of factors, and a lot has to do with how boys are brought up, the environment they're brought up in, whether they're brought up in single-parent households by women who have influences over these boys, because there is no doubt, from experience, boys are usually good to their mothers and fine, and their attitudes to them are fine. They start to change in puberty. And the only people who can address that, with assistance from people from universities or state or private entities, but the only people who can really look at that and address it and say, what messages are we sending to boys? And it is about culture. And it is about long-standing patterns of behavior. It has to happen to the people. So in other words, all those, and absolutely supportive of them, but all those girls who went out and said, you know, we very angry about this. Yes, but this is not, going to the state is not going to solve the problem.
Absolutely. And Nick, I'm looking at you here because we've been saying for a very long time that, and I must quickly buttress this statement with this, but by saying this, you know, we as liberals are always accused of not being in the conversation on social issues and being able to understand society through a social lens or sociological lens. So let's have that brief conversation, Nick. Nick, I'm gonna put something to you, just riding off of what Sarah said. Nick, last year in this country, stats say came out of the data saying 62% of all new births in this country had no information on the father whatsoever on there. And we know this is a big issue. When I was still in my other hat, my past hat, if you will, being in the social development department, we knew, for instance, that at Polesmore Prison, the vast majority of individuals, when they were polled, indicated, who were in, obviously, there for serious crimes and the like, indicated there was no father figure at all in their household, and that the father figure, the closest male figure for them, was the gangster, for example, in the street, who, by the way, is conscious of the breakdown of the family and is playing, coaxing young people in on the guise of being the macho fatherly figure for young people. This is a serious problem that I think we need to address in terms of looking at where societies are strongest, and that societies are strongest when families are looked after. And by the way, as liberals, we always say this, families can take any iteration, really, but you do want to have stable, safe, and spaces that have positive role models in the household, including a positive male figure. Nick, talk to us. Why has there been such a breakdown of the family, and what can we do about this?
I mean, look, there's a large number of reasons, and a lot of them are quite difficult to fix. But two things you could probably do immediately is study the effects of our grant system and how exactly it changes family structures, because in a lot of countries, our own included, the grant structure changes the way that people decide whether they're going to get married or how they're going to structure their families. The other thing is we need to kind of break up that old legacy of the colonial and apartheid eras, which is the migrant labor system. And one of the ways you can do that is by reform of state-owned land and the chieftain-owned land, which would allow fathers to live with it in the same place as their children. Because the sociological data is pretty clear on this, that boys who grow up without a positive male role model usually a biological father, but it can be any sort of positive male influence, will be more likely to resort to crime, to get involved in drugs, to be generally violent, to have problems in their romantic life. So it is very important that we kind of fix the family. There's one other thing that my colleagues kind of talked a bit about, but I think bears repeating, is the police need to be trained better to deal with these sort of issues. The anecdotal evidence is pretty clear on this. If you kind of talk to people who've had to deal with the police after sort of some kind of sexual violence, the police are often either dismissive or incompetent. Mm. And there's a lot of very bad treatment of women who go to actually report, you know, go through the process and try and get the people off the streets. The police sometimes will ignore them, or they'll be callous, or they'll, you know, make them face the rapist immediately after they've been arrested. It's very unpleasant, and so that is something that government can do right away to try and reduce the negative effects of sexual violence.
Now, what I would just want to say, there have been incidents where women report rape at a police station and end up being raped by the police, by the officers in charge. And the only problem is, and this is why I think community involvement, although I know it's actually very difficult to set up structures with the police, nice as it may sound. But what you can do is there can be groups and community people in particular who can assist the person who's been raped to go to a police station. They mustn't have to do it on their own, because they face this, and because the top of the police has been so decimated by corruption and incompetence, the necessary teaching and instruction is not going to come down anytime soon, unfortunately.
And guys, just very briefly, maybe because we need to move on to the next topic, the incompetence and the corruption that Ususara brings up has real world effects. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the longest of times, it was rectified recently. The vast majority of police stations didn't even have rape kits, guys. Mm-hmm. So you could rock up at a police station, and as a victim, you've done the right things. You haven't taken a bath and all that stuff that you're warned against. But the state fails you by not actually having not only the infrastructure, but also, as Nicholas pointed out, the well-trained staff that can deal with these issues properly in an empathetic way, and also in a way which can ensure justice, being able to collect evidence, etc., etc. So that actually some of the recommendations we're making in the community safety charter are realistic, everyday, low-hanging fruits to fix this. Professionalizing the police, bringing it up to a level where it's more higher education level, if you will, of our police officers and the like. So guys, please check that out on our website. Go to irr.org.za and look for the community safety charter tab, and please pledge your name on this so that we can bring your voice into the echelons of power and bring real change into this country. Guys, I'm going to move us to our last topic. We have a couple of minutes on this. Something that sort of broke the news over the weekend, to much jubilation, I think, generally, and fake virtue signaling from the political elites. Again, this is a topic that really demonstrates that big chasm between ordinary people and the elites in this country. One Robert Gabriel Mugabe dies in a luxury Singapore hospital. Ironies of ironies. And, you know, the vast majority, I think, of sane people were like, hey man, good riddance. This man was a bad influence, he was a dictator, he was evil, essentially. And his death, you know, is no skin off our backs. But of course, the political elites in this country were like, oh, the death of this man should be venerated. We miss him. He was so great, the liberator. Who am I going to go to first? Morris. That big difference was quite palpable to see between the political elites and ordinary people, wasn't it?
Well, what was the most interesting was to see how actual Zimbabweans were talking about it. And there was very few ordinary Zimbabweans that I saw on Twitter were saying, oh, this is terrible. They're saying this is so great. This man destroyed our country. He's the, you know, he took a country that worked really well and he ran it into the ground. But also I put on this on Twitter, and I saw Floyd Chivambu, the deputy leader of the EFF. Also, why do they have a deputy leader when their leader is called the CRC? Surely he should be deputy commander. But anyway, so Anyway, so Floyd tweeted, oh, Roberts, it's so sad, blah, 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 stuff about the war isn't over. But in 2013, I was doing my master's at Wits and I had a class with Floyd. And he always used to go on about how amazing the land reform program in Zimbabwe was and Rob Mugabe's such a great guy. And we had two or three Zimbabwean guys in the class and all of them would always say to him, Floyd, you don't know what you're talking about. Every time I go back to Zimbabwe, it's worse. Floyd would be like, no, you know, you just didn't do it right. And the thing is, like, when they get, like, such clear evidence that this is a bad idea. Look, nobody's saying that land reform, there mustn't be land reform or ownership patterns don't need to change in some way, but taking away people's property without paying for it, as happened in Zimbabwe, is a terrible idea. It never works and shows you somebody like Floyd can't even see the evidence for his own eyes because they're so blind about ideology.
Absolutely.
In the discussion over his death, we've seen a reoccurrence of a very popular kind of myth of the story of Mugabe, which is that he starts as this great liberation leader and turns into a mad dictator. But that's rubbish. Mm. Mugabe has always been a violent thug. And, you know, there was stuff he did in the war and stuff, but, you know, you can maybe excuse that by saying, oh, well, that's what it's like. You know, he was in a period of war. But the moment he comes to power, there's a simmering sort of rebellion by one of the other liberation groups, and he carries out the Gukurahundi, I believe it's pronounced, where there were massacres, particularly targeting the Indibele people in Zimbabwe, which amounts to a genocide. So in the first few years of his presidency, he was carrying out a genocide with North Korean-trained troops. That is not someone who should be venerated in any way by our political elites.
I think if you check all the eulogies that were talked about him positively and mentioned nothing about the negative, came from parties around Africa who have not lost an election. So he would be their hero in that regard. So,
but also, I just want to say this just shows the hypocrisy of the West as well. When Rob Mugabe was, as Nick pointed out, was killing 20,000 Ndebele people in Matabele land, he was being feted around the world. He got an honorary knighthood, all kinds of things. It's only when he started kicking white people off their farms that suddenly people realized he was this awful dictator. So, and that's also something people like the AFF, they celebrate all what Rob Mugabe did to white Zimbabweans and they ignore what he did to ordinary black Zimbabweans. So people, you can just see the blatant hypocrisy from the West and within, yeah, in South Africa.
Guys, thank you very much. I have to sort of cut it off here. This topic will go on and on and on and on, and on because really is that sort of I think it inspired a guttural disgust in most people watching Pete sort of venerate this guy as some hero that he's really not. Guys, thank you very much for this wonderful episode, and thank you to the listener for listening to us. This is your Monday edition. Hopefully we've set the news agenda for you for the week, things that you must watch out for, of course, and provided some analysis on things that maybe you were keeping an eye on. Remember, you can support the work of our colleagues who you've heard here in a studio by becoming a friend of the IRR. That is our crowdfunding campaign, how we get together the resources we need to do the work that we do. You can do that by SMSing your name to 32823. An SMS will cost you 1 rand. Terms and conditions do apply. Or hey, find us online, irr.org.za/join, where you can sign up for a monthly debit order of 90 rand. Guys, it's 5 cups of coffee that you will spend in a month. But those funds go a long way in supporting the work that we do. Remember, you find all our work at www.dailyfriend.co.za. Guys, we'll catch you on the Wednesday edition of the Daily Friend. See you then.